Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, here to welcome you to another edition of Valley Writers Read. Tonight, we have a story by a writer who lives up in the foothills in Mariposa, Flora Beach Burlingame. We've never had a story on this subject before, therefore we know you'll find it most interesting. The title is A Teacher of the Freedmen, and it tells the story of our author's own grandfather, John Stevenson, who, right after the Civil War, volunteered to teach former slaves to read and to write. So here now is Larry Patton to read Flora Beach Burlingame's story, A Teacher of the Freedmen.
A Teacher of the Freedmen, America, 1867. The voice of the guest preacher from the American Missionary Association thundered with conviction at the little church in Minnesota that fateful morning, igniting a fire in 24-year-old John Stevenson unlike any he had ever known. "They need our help," George Whipple pounded the pulpit. "These poor, ignorant black folk released from bondage and totally unprepared to fend for themselves in a hostile society, it is our duty as Christians to guide them, put them on their feet, teach them. Do you know someone who would take up this important cause? Would you be willing to meet this challenge for the good of mankind?" It seemed to John the man spoke directly to him, looking deep into his eyes the entire time, filling him with questions. At the end of the service, he hung back until the crowd of parishioners eager to shake the hand of the guest finally thinned. Stepping forward, Bible in hand, and the tension of anticipation tight in his gut, he cleared his throat. "John Stevenson, sir, may I speak with you?"
"Certainly, son. How may I help?"
A look of eagerness snapped in Whipple's eyes.
"What sort of credentials are necessary for these teachers you seek?"
"A willing heart, an open mind, and a love for our Lord Savior Jesus Christ."
Whipple studied John as he rattled off the phrase, obviously one often used.
"Are you interested?"
"Aye, perhaps. I have no formal education, no college, that is, though I have been teaching a few months at a school here in Rice Lake."
"I see. What is your background?"
"You're certainly not a Minnesota native."
"Bannockburn, Scotland, sir. Just 2 years in America. I've been working on a farm and teaching at the school since harvest."
"Well, you must be a God-fearing man. Are you and be in church on this beautiful Sunday morning? Have a seat, son, and let's talk."
Whipple motioned to a pew in the now empty sanctuary.
Well, one thing led to another, and before John knew it, he had obligated himself for an undetermined chunk of his future, teaching a people about whom he knew almost nothing. But how could this job be any harder than instructing a handful of prairie children? There were risks. He knew that. Many Southerners were opposed to their former slaves having an education. But wouldn't the Freedmen's Bureau be close by to help with problems? These were their schools, after all, set up to help the colored folk in their new role as freed people and aided by the missionaries. Aye, he would tackle this worthy cause. It would make his father, Deacon of the Little Kirk in Scotland, proud.
"We are climbing Jacob ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder. We are climbing Jacob's ladder, soldiers of the cross.
3 months later, John found himself in Texas, so far away from Scotland and Minnesota. A long train ride to New Orleans, then a steamer to Galveston, and another to Indianola, where he connected with Lieutenant Mitchell, an agent for the Bureau of Refugees, Freedmen, and Abandoned Lands.
John Stevenson, reporting as instructed, sir. He handed the officer two pieces of papers, assigning him to teach the freedmen, one from the Freedmen's Bureau and the other from the American Missionary Association. Mitchell glanced at the documents, then handed them back.
Well, I'm certainly glad to see you. General Griffin is getting mighty impatient about starting that school, and I've got enough worries without him breathing down my neck.
He reached out and shook John's hand.
Have a seat.
The lieutenant indicated a straight-back chair while he took one behind a desk.
You'll be starting a school at Lavaca, a small town about 15 miles up the bay from here. Your first job will be finding a building for the school, then spread the word you're open for business, so to speak. A French family by the name of Duval has offered you room and board, at least until you get settled.
Dipping a pen into an ink bottle, he scribbled down Pierre Duval on a piece of paper and pushed it across the desk.
John picked it up, studied it a moment, then folded and placed it in his waistcoat pocket. What about books and other teaching tools?
Books? You'll have to get those through the Missionary Association for now. The Bureau might be able to help with that later.
Money's in short supply.
You'll be glad you get a paycheck.
You'll need benches. We'll help you with those. And the rent for whatever building you find for holding school in.
Well, that's pretty much it.
John's jaw tightened. Whipple had said there would be supplies. How could he start a school without the proper tools?
In his most determined voice, he announced, I'll have to have books.
Books and slates.
Mitchell eyed John steadily, a slight smirk on his face, drumming his fingers on the table before replying, It appears to me you're putting the cart before the horse. You don't even have a place to teach at yet.
Like I said, write to the AMA for school supplies. That's about it for now. I'll be coming up and checking on things periodically. You can get messages to me on the lighters that come down the bay or send someone on a horse around the back way. Any questions?
John stared at the man incredulously.
That's it? 15 short minutes of orientation for the most important job of my life?
All he could do was shake his head, no, guessing he'd work it out when he got there. The AMA had given him some basics about teaching the former slaves, and he had received valuable lessons from observing a freedman's school during a stopover in Galveston. That would have to do. Obviously, it was not a job of the Bureau to show him the way. He stood to leave.
Oh, and one more thing, Stevenson, Mitchell said, rising from his chair. Do you own a gun?
John looked at him in surprise.
No, sir. Better get one in town before you head on out.
A lot of white folk don't like the idea of educating the freedmen.
Things aren't as bad here as they are in East Texas, but it's still not too popular, what we're doing.
Never know when you might need to protect yourself.
I understood troops were quartered here in Indianola to provide support, John said.
That's true. But you're a ways up the bay, and it might be too late before we get any hint of trouble. He tossed out the words as though they were of no real consequence before ending the conversation with a handshake and, good luck! As John stepped out into the street, the agent's parting statement chilled him more than the cold morning wind. So, his success with the freedmen, and perhaps his very life, depended on luck, did it?
Well, he certainly had a lot more than that to rely upon. He had his faith in God to give him strength for whatever lay ahead, and he most certainly was not going to buy a gun. John found the little town of Lavaca to his liking, and not threatening at all. With the help of his landlords, the Duvals, he found and rented the upstairs of an old warehouse along the bay for use as a schoolroom. He spread the word best he could that classes for former slaves, plus any refugees of the war, would begin at 9 o'clock the following Monday morning. And now he was about to meet his pupils for the first time. Conflicting thoughts spun around in his mind. What if no one came? Or worse, what if they did come? And he discovered, as several folks had suggested, that the coloreds weren't teachable. What if they came, but didn't like him? John paced the rough, slanting floor of the drafty warehouse. A tight feeling in his stomach spread to every muscle until he felt like dry kindling ready to ignite. Footsteps sounded on the stairs, and a black, curly head peered around the open door. "This here be the school place? Aye, lassie. Do come in and take a seat." John motioned to planks laid across packing boxes. A girl about 8 eased into the building. 2 followed her, a young woman perhaps in her 20s holding the hand of a small boy, and then several more wide-eyed children entered. For the next half hour they came, wedging together on the makeshift benches. The pupils, well scrubbed and dressed in what John guessed to be their best clothing, ranged in age from a boy about 4 to Mrs. Wallace, a middle-aged woman, and represented skin color of the blackest black to white and every hue in between, including the browns of Mexico. John had not expected this mixture, although it should not have surprised him. The Bureau, after all, was established to protect and provide for the needs of not only the freedmen, but any refugees of the war. A hush filled the room. All eyes were upon him as he addressed the class for the first time. 55 bodies crowded onto the benches. 55! More than he had ever imagined, and most likely more than one teacher could manage. With hands clasped behind him, he struck a stance to appear scholarly and self-assured. Trembling fingers concealed. The commitment to teach this unexpected throng suddenly overwhelmed him. There was nothing to do but forge ahead. After introducing himself and stating a few rules of deportment, the lessons began. Without textbooks, slates, or pen and paper, he had printed the alphabet with charcoal onto a wide board nailed to the wall. Pointing out the 26 letters, John remarked, "Words are made up of a combination of all these symbols. By the end of the week, each of you will know how to read and write your own name." An immediate hum of excitement spread through the room, and John worked his way from one letter to the next in distinct pronunciation, repeating each twice. "Now comes the fun part," he said. "One at a time, I will ask your name, and we will put together the letters that spell it." Again, a rumble rolled from wall to wall. He motioned to a boy of about 12, sitting in the front row. "You get to be the first, laddie. What is your name?" "Jeremy," the boy said, his eyes large and round with anticipation. John lifted a thin board from a stack of 20 he had cut from packing crates and pinned "Jeremy" across the surface. Holding up for all to see, he called out each letter before handing it to the boy. "As soon as we get slates, you can practice making the letters yourself." Jeremy fingered the board with awe, tracing the parts of his name with a grin so wide it seemed his face would split. Classmates crowded around, touching his treasure. "Let me see! Me next! No, me!" The enthusiasm filling the room sprang through John like a spark escaping a campfire, and he almost forgot it was his job to control the class.
Rapping on the desk, he eventually gained order. "Everyone will have a turn," he said. Still, as the lettering was done for each pupil, the commotion erupted again. Finally, when no more boards remained, John dismissed the class, though it was only noon. "Tomorrow, bring a lunch and plan to stay until 2. That will be our regular hours, 9 until 2. He needed the extra time now to make more nameplates. He lunched on a thick slice of bread and a slab of cheese washed down by strong coffee as he worked. By the time he had cut 30 more plates, a blister throbbed on his right thumb, and daylight had softened into dusk. In Minnesota, the most challenging part of John's teaching experience had been from the pupils who didn't want to go to school. Here in Texas, at least during the first week, there was none of that. In fact, pandemonium due to the excitement of being there created his biggest problem. But with the help of his oldest pupil, Mrs. Wallace, a very motherly, no-nonsense woman, routine and order began to fall into place. Each day, after the scholars left, John stayed to prepare classes for the following morning. Then at nightfall, he took a short walk along the bay before heading for his rented room. Some of his pupils lived in shacks near the water, and he wanted to familiarize himself with their homes. Plus, the evening breezes and salt air helped soothe away the tensions of this career so new to him. Though his landlord had more than once expressed concern for John's safety, he figured he couldn't go about town thinking every shadow would jump out and grab him. And so on Friday, to celebrate the end of his first week as a teacher of the freedmen, John felt confident and relaxed enough to linger a little longer on the waterfront. As he strolled toward the pier, a small ship bumped lazily against the pilings, a thin trail of steam curling from its stack, disappearing into the night sky. "I'll walk to the end of the wharf and back before heading home," he thought. There seemed to be very little activity this late in the day, and except for lights in the ship's cabin casting swaying yellow rectangles across the water, the way was dark. A man in uniform passed him, perhaps the captain of the vessel, who tipped his cap and continued on to town. Further along the dock, John made out the silhouettes of several men, laughing and, he suspected, drunk with whiskey. At first he couldn't hear the conversation, but as he slowed and came closer, slurred words became more audible and chilling. "The school lets out about now. If we hurry, we can catch him before he gets far. Grab that there rope." "You gonna hang him?" another voice croaked. "Maybe, maybe not. Leastways we can scare him good. Get him out of Lavaca. Don't need no northern carpetbaggers here teaching our colors." John froze, as though the words had been shoved down his throat. They were talking about him. Heart pounding, he turned and walked swiftly and silently in the direction he had come, off the wharf and onto solid ground. Warnings of Pierre and Lieutenant Mitchell merged with the laughter of the huddled men, exploding inside his head. Were the voices coming closer? He dare not turn around. Surely the dark of the night kept him from being seen. But he couldn't risk the long, open gap between the end of the wharf and the top of the bluff. Stepping into the shadows of a small utility building, the only cover in sight, he willed his labored breathing to hush. Over the drumming of his heartbeats, he strained to hear footsteps and voices. Multiple thuds on the wharf's wooden planks grew near, then softened as they transferred to the earthen walkway so close to his hiding spot. A voice, thick with whiskey, penetrated the darkness, calling out to an approaching figure. "Hey, you all seen that warehouse teacher? We got a present for him." The snap, snap of a rope cracked in the crisp night air, and John could almost feel it constrict around his neck, pushing away his last breath. A recent warning by the Duvals throbbed in his head. A teacher of the Freedmen in northern Texas was beaten almost to death only a few days ago. John tried to swallow, but no spit came. One sound, and he was a dead man, for sure. Fear ran through him like hot grease, forming one thought. He must leave Texas. Laughter crackled through the darkness, a hilarity devoid of humor. "Speak up, man! You seen that there, Mr. Stevenson? Now, you men don't mean no harm, do you? Nothing real serious. Just want to teach the teacher hisself a little lesson, like maybe he don't belong here." More laughter, rippling through John like a serrated knife. The group of men stood no more than 20 feet away. "Nope, can't say that I seen him, leastways not tonight, though he does often walk the shore in the evening." Who was that speaking? John wondered. Obviously someone he nodded to or greeted as he strolled after classes, and no doubt considered a friend, though he was learning an affable face on the surface often mask a contrary core within. John preferred those who outright objected to his teaching the freedmen. Not that he cared much for them either, but at least he knew where they stood.
"Shucks, guess there won't be no fun tonight."
When only the soft lapping of the bay water against the shore met his ears, John eased away from the building. Making his way below the bluff, he questioned once more the wisdom of coming to this remote town on the Texas Gulf. All the benevolence poured into his Scots Presbyterian upbringing wasn't worth a half penny if he ended up twisting in the wind from a tree branch. Tomorrow, he would leave on the first boat out of Lavaca and seek another, safer missionary placement up north. Working his way along the sand toward his rented room, he stopped now and then to check for malevolent shadows behind. His accelerated pulse rate slowed with each step as it became apparent his pursuers were gone, saving their hatred for another day. Pale crisscross patterns of light slanted outward from windows of the shacks below the bluff, the yellow streaks flickering as the candle flames from their source waltzed in a breeze. Suddenly, a dark figure leaped into a beam no more than 6 feet away. John's knees jellied, and his breath caught in his throat, struggling to erupt in a strangled yell.
"Is that you, teacher?"
a young male voice questioned. John almost choked with relief.
"Jeremy, you gave me a start. I knows you walk out here after class. I come to find you."
"What's so important that you need to scare me half to death?"
"I come to tell you I can do it."
Excitement jangled in the voice. "Do it?" John's fright had clogged his mind.
"The letters, sir. All them letters."
"Letters?"
"Yes, sir. I know I can tell you the next class time, but this year is Friday, and I have to wait clear till Monday. Can I tell you now?"
"Of course," John said, still sorting through the question. Right then, in the dark, along the bay to the rhythm of soft ripples of water, Jeremy began reciting the alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. With each letter, the pitch of the young man's voice rose. By the time he reached K, his toe was a-tapping. At Q, his hands clapped to the beat in the finale. X, Y, Z segued into a dance. The moonless night could not hide the joy radiating from this newly acquired knowledge. Unconsciously, John began to clap to the same ecstatic tune. "Hooray! Hooray! And this is just the beginning, Jeremy. There is so much more to teach you.
I'll be there, teacher. I'll be there on Monday."
And he danced away, singing A, B, C, D, E, F, G. John pulled out a handkerchief, blew his nose, and wiped the tears trickling down his cheeks. For the remainder of the distance home, a definite cadence rocked his steps as he concentrated on Monday's lesson for Jeremy and his classmates.
Any notion of catching a boat in the morning had flown at the joy of witnessing one youngster dance to the alphabet in the dark of the night.
Come by here, my love.
So on Monday, after many prayers and soul-searching, but mainly because of Jeremy's unbridled pride, school began as usual with John in his place at the front of the room. He chose not to mention the incident on the wharf to the Duvalls, his landlords. It would only worry them, though it was a while before he was able to take a broader view of the situation. Once calmed down, he focused on the many folks in Lavaca who had befriended him, the Duvalls, of course, and the merchant who helped him put together the temporary benches. And hadn't Brahman and company been willing to rent him the warehouse room for his school? It wasn't as though the entire community was teeming with murderous intent. The men involved in his scare on the waterfront had been drunk, and he figured they probably didn't even recall the events of Friday evening. For a short while, John considered purchasing a gun, but argued himself out of that senseless thought. He was not going to hide behind a weapon, which might cause more problems than it would solve, and he was not going to turn and run. "Look at all I have accomplished in only 1 week. 55 enthusiastic scholars and Jeremy. Bless Jeremy."
"Oh, don't you want to go?
Land where all is peace, Lord,
I want to cross over into campground.
Deep river, deep river, my home is over Jordan.
Primers and slates finally arrived, and it was time to advance from the spelling of names to learning common words. John was not discouraged by those who still looked perplexed. Instead, thought back to the little schoolhouse in Rice Lake, Minnesota. There were those who grasped lessons immediately, and others for whom it took a while longer. Skin color and location seemed not to matter. Each at his own speed, he thought. Each at his own speed. The enthusiasm of these scholars, who some had dubbed unteachable, was its own reward.
"My mammy say if I got enough learning, I can be a teacher too,"
10-year-old Melinda told John right off. He met such confidence with contradicting emotions. He thrilled to have determined and motivated students, yet moments of inadequacy plagued him. Should he fail at his task, it would also mean failure for all the Melindas with high and mighty dreams. Truth of the matter was, he could never have coped without the help of Mrs. Wallace. More than his assistant, she had become the self-proclaimed matriarch of the class, and her mothering in no way excluded the teacher. John willingly allowed the older woman to assume this role and, like everyone else, respectfully referred to her as Mrs. Wallace. She always stayed after school to help him tidy up the room. This insightful woman seemed particularly aware of John's personal challenges.
"I just don't see how come that bureau don't get you more help," she would sputter. "Lord knows one man can't never teach all these chillens by himself." She'd click her tongue and huff in loyal dismay.
Neither did Mrs. Wallace's keen sense of observation miss the fact that many townspeople refused to associate with John. One day, after school, as he and Mrs. Wallace walked together on Main Street before going their separate ways, John observed two women with shopping bags strolling toward them. The women suddenly stopped, whispered to each other, and hurried to the opposite side of the street, obviously avoiding them. "Eh, be afeard," Mrs. Wallace said, shaking her head. A tiny wave of alarm rippled through John. Afraid? He could partially understand their unhappiness, or even anger at him for raising the level of the freedmen in society, but to be afraid? Fear did strange things to people, this he knew, and their actions could be unpredictable. His thoughts raced back to that terrifying night on the waterfront. Mrs. Wallace's comment wedged into the back of his mind and lodged there. Along with Lieutenant Mitchell's suggestion, he buy a gun. Yet he refused to allow it to interfere with his task of teaching. Rewards, though tiny and infrequent, wove in and out through the days and weeks of tedious instruction. "Melinda, how do you spell home?"
"Home, H-O-M-E, home."
"Jeremy, what is the sum of 8 and 12?
20, sir."
Such moments as these transferred the triumphant smiles of the pupils directly into John's heart. Each success overrode the sterner times so necessary to maintain order in the large class. Then there were the times when excitement energized and linked all together. Such a day occurred when real benches, as promised by the Bureau, arrived at last.
"Oh, teacher!"
Melinda squealed as she walked through the door and spied the new seatings. She fluffed her skirts and plopped in the middle of the front row, the brilliant smile across her face as she sat there swinging her legs, made John wonder if she ever planned to leave. The scent of freshly planed and sanded wood perfumed the room to the point of intoxication. The width of the benches accommodated posteriors of all sizes far better than planks on crates. John had ordered an extra row, and for the first time since school opened, the pupils could sit without feeling attached to his or her neighbor. Joyful comments echoed throughout the room.
"I ain't so squeezed now. Lord Jesus, thank you. Just like a real schoolroom in pictures. Yay!"
The chatter continued for the first hour before subsiding, but John sensed a communal sigh of relief at the more comfortable seating that seemed to spur his pupils on to their best scholarly efforts. As days tumbled one after another into weeks, John became accustomed to his role, and he sensed his students respected and appreciated his efforts. Though he occasionally heard negative rumblings in the community about that Northerner teaching our coloreds, it seemed his reason for being there had generally been accepted. Until that cold morning, he found a notice tacked to the schoolroom door.
"Attention!"
The heading on the fluttering paper screamed at him. "Brethren of the Klan and Friends of the South." John read on, his gut twisting tighter with each vile word. "To carpetbaggers, enemies to our blood and country, we say beware. You are clogs on the wheels of our prosperity. To you we may have smiling faces and extended hands, but our hearts are envenomed, and we will act accordingly." John tore the appalling message from the door, his fingers trembling. Who were these charlatans with smiling faces and extended hands? The reality of the sobering thought caused him to react in a way he swore never to do. He marched to the general store and purchased a revolver. He prayed to God he would never use it, but kept it in his desk at school during the day and under his pillow at night. Now, a constant question hovered in the back of his mind. When would this group carry out its menacing threat? That the Klan was active in the community became apparent only a few short weeks later. Ever since his scare on the wharf, John no longer strolled down by the water.
He had taken to hiking across the prairie, where he could spend 2 hours or more and never meet another person. The carpet of wildflowers under his feet, the wide open spaces, and a canopy of blue sky invigorated him, and he felt safe. One Saturday evening, as the sun rested on the horizon, John turned to retrace his steps toward home following a pleasant walk. A breeze played tag with his coattails and rustled the spindly limbs of the mesquite. Deep breaths of the shifting air energized his stride. It had been a satisfying day. By the time he reached the outskirts of town, twilight laid shadows along the roadway. A group of horsemen emerged from a distance, and John watched with curiosity as others joined them, still too far to make out who they might be. Excited shouts drifted on the wind, horses whinnied, and the assembly gathered speed, galloping in his direction. As he watched them approach, he noticed something peculiar. They appeared to be in some sort of costume, all dressed alike. An icy tremor trickled through him, and the KKK notice tacked to the schoolroom door flashed in his mind. His mouth went dry. Hoping the distance and twilight had not yet revealed him to the horsemen, he quickly slipped behind a bush, the only shelter immediately at hand. The group thundered by minutes later, obviously intent on a destination well beyond where he stood. They were a sight to behold. Each rider, and there must have been at least a dozen, wore some sort of hood over his head with two holes cut for eyes, a ghoulish lot with covert intentions. John stood rooted until the sound pounding in his ears was no longer that of horses' hooves, but only his own heartbeats. Waiting until dark, he made his way home at a pace just under a run. That night, as his head lay on the pillow, the hardness of the revolver beneath it. Every hint of a noise caused him to jump. Any moment, he half expected to look up and see a ghostly figure leaning over the bed, eyes peering out of blank holes.
I've been in a storm so long. This is a needed time. Singing, this is a needed time. Singing, I've been in a storm so long.
He did not feel prepared for class the next morning, his brain foggy from lack of sleep.
I won't mention the Klansmen to the scholars. It will only cause alarm, he thought.
Yet the moments the pupils began to arrive, he sensed something different. As each took his or her place, an abnormal hush hung thick over the classroom. By 9:15, only half the benches were filled. Even Mrs. Wallace crept in silently at the last minute.
"Where is everyone?" John asked.
She glanced around, connecting with the fear-ridden eyes of her classmates. In a shaky voice, she said,
"Well, sir, Mr. Stevenson, we had us a terrible fright."
Jeremy jumped up, his rapid breathing wheezing out words.
"Ghosts, sir. Ghosts riding on horses in the dark. We hear they're looking for colored to hang and...
John picked up the Bible from his desk, clutching it until his knuckles paled, waiting for Jeremy to finish.
"And kill white folks who take up with us."
The boy slumped back on the bench, unable to look John in the eye. Melinda started to cry. The fear clustered in the room, curdled the air, making it hard to breathe. It was John's place to calm shattered nerves. What should he say? Standing tall as though full of confidence and still gripping the Bible, he spoke.
"I saw those ghosts last night, and yes, they were scary.
But they weren't really ghosts at all, but cowardly men who have to hide behind sheets to scare others because they are afraid themselves, afraid of change. We need to pray for them and all of the Texas and the South while everyone adjusts to living together differently than in the past. He stopped to steady his voice. And for a moment, the only sound to be heard was the tap, tap, tap of raindrops knocking at the window. Inhaling deeply, John continued, "The wisest thing to do is keep on learning. Let's continue with our lessons." He set the Bible down and picked up a primer. No one moved. All eyes focused on their teacher. An unanswered question on each face. "What is it?" John asked, an uneasy feeling creeping through him. Heads turned toward Mrs. Wallace, who stood at the rear of the room. Folding her arms across her bosom for support, she began in a quavering voice, "Well, sir, we is afraid you're going to pack up and leave on account of them writers." A few uh-huhs murmured through the group, and Melinda let out another sob. John felt a stirring in his chest. "They are as afraid for me as for themselves." The thought struck with the same intensity as though the Lord himself had spoken. Swallowing a lump rising in his throat, John scanned each pleading face. Unlike his scare on the waterfront so many months ago, there was now no thought of leaving. He simply couldn't. This unique blend of folks, all ages and colors, believed in him and had wiggled their way into his very soul. "You can stop your worrying. I have no intention of leaving Lavaca. You are too important to me." Smiles appeared, a cacophony of voices tumbled out, and primers picked up. "Page 37, John said. "Jeremy, would you please read?"
That was Larry Patton reading Flora Beach Burlingame's story, A Teacher of the Freedmen. As we told you in the introduction, the lead character in her story, John Stevenson, was the author's actual grandfather. And as we heard, right after the Civil War, the American Missionary Association took it upon itself to take on the job of teaching roughly 4 million new citizens how to read and write, inasmuch as it was legally forbidden to do so in the South before the end of the Civil War. John comes across as a dedicated, patient, and superior teacher, but unfortunately there were many in the community where he worked who resented folks like him for doing what he was doing. Our story confirms what history tells us, that the Ku Klux Klan had a big following in the former Confederacy. Undoubtedly, the fear of being mobbed, or much worse, must have caused people like John Stevenson great care. Even though he resisted the idea for quite some time, we notice that he finally did purchase a weapon to protect himself. We give him and many others like him a great deal of credit for the wonderful work they did. And you know, we also give his granddaughter a lot of credit for researching and writing such an inspiring profile. Friends, Flora Beach Burlingame has written a book dealing with the story we heard tonight. In addition, she is the author of several newspaper columns for the Fresno Bee and the Sierra Gateway. She's also written articles for Lamas International, Sierra Heritage, and Woman's World. Thank you for your story tonight, Flora. We hope you're busy writing another one for us for next year. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer reader will be Ed Miller. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.